Welcome back to Undisclosed, our special coverage this season covering the case against Adnan Syed, the HBO docuseries that has recently been released. And this week, Rabia here, and I'm joined with Susan and Colin to discuss episode 2, In Between the Truth. Hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey. This is our first time recording together, all three of us, since the decision.
So last Friday, we got word that the Court of Appeals of Maryland had reinstated Adnan's conviction. And it was really kind of shocking to me. And I'm still, every so often, I'm reminded and I'm like, oh, I forgot that happened. Oh, my God. And, you know, I still personally have not been able to bring myself to read the opinion. I have spoken to Adnan's mother and to Adnan and to his lawyer, Justin, multiple times. They're doing okay. They're hanging in there. And the irony of all this is it ends up being Adnan and his mom giving me and Justin like consolation and telling us to be okay and we'll be okay. And, one thing Adnan said to me was, he said, you know, we've been in worse spots over the years with less resources. And he's right. So we're marching forward. I had a meltdown for a couple of hours and then I was like, all right, let's get this shit together. Let's keep going. And so we have lots of multiple legal options that and we're ready to pursue every single one. Now, if you want to hear more in-depth discussion about the actual opinion and what happened, Susan and Colin were on the addenda last week and you can check that out and see what they had to say about it. And of course, Colin has been blogging ferociously about the opinion. And thank you for that, Colin, as always. There are a lot of things that I would rather be doing than going grocery shopping, and that's because all of us have a ton of things to do, and it takes time. And I'll be honest, I can never make one trip to the grocery store. I go and get something, and I always forget stuff. It just never fails. I end up making multiple trips, then I send my husband. But we don't have to do that anymore, and neither do you, because we've got Instacart. With Instacart, you get groceries delivered in as little as 1 hour or at any time that works in your schedule. They've got exclusive coupons, so you can save money with coupons on pantry staples. And I'll be honest, I am also that person who forgets to take coupons. I'll clip coupons once in a while, but then they just get unused because I forget to actually take them with me. But I won't do that with Instacart because there's an app. And Instacart is available at all of your favorite stores. You can get groceries delivered from local and national retailers. Now, you can go to the app or you can go to instacart.com and shop the groceries you need from your favorite local retailers. Your shopper gathers your groceries with care by selecting excellent produce and contacting you if they need a little more information. And your groceries will arrive in as little as 1 hour or whenever you want. They keep the hot items hot and the cold items cold. So try Instacart and get $10 off your first order. To get this limited time offer, go to instacart.com or download the mobile app and enter our promo code undisclosed at checkout. That's $10 off your first order today at instacart.com or through the mobile app. And don't forget to enter our code undisclosed. Instacart.com or again through the mobile app with our code undisclosed at checkout. Let's get into episode 2, which opens up on February 3rd, 2016, and the second post-conviction hearing in Adnan's case.
We are nervous but hopeful. I mean, I think we haven't had this much hope for success in a long time. It is kind of our also, at the same time, our last best shot.
This episode is definitely the episode for people who are, you know, been following the case intensely for years, listened to Undisclosed and Serial. It's the one with the least new material, the most that's kind of a recounting of stuff that, quote unquote, everybody already knows. But remember, lots of people, this will be the first time they're ever hearing it.
Although we are introduced to some new folks in this episode, and I think even new to me, like people I have not kind of seen on camera before and heard from in any kind of official interviews or anything like that. But the episode opens up with Thiru Vignaraja, the prosecutor in the case, holding a press conference outside of the courthouse at the post-conviction and reading a statement from Heyman Lee's family. And I remember that happening. And he held a couple of little pressers like that, which was very reminiscent of the prosecutor in Making a Murderer.
We believe justice was done when Adnan was convicted in 2000. And we look forward to bringing this chapter to an end. But we are grateful to all the people who are there to give Hay a voice. She is the true victim.
And I just don't know how common that is in a PCR proceeding.
It's not common for that much attention to be present at a PCR hearing.
What do you guys think about the family statement? Do you remember when that happened?
I do. I mean, it's obviously clear they didn't write it, but I'm sure they agreed with it and agreed to issue it. It's understandable. I mean, I can't imagine feeling any other way.
Yeah. For folks who might not know, none of the family was actually present at the hearing, but members of their community were there. I don't think any of the family lives locally anymore anyways, but there were members of the community, at least for the first couple of days, and then I think they petered out. Now, I don't know exactly, because I did not get to stay inside the courthouse very long.
It was good to see Dunkin' Donuts again. I was like, oh, memories.
Dunkin' Donuts did not figure as heavily as I thought it would. Yeah, I got kicked out about 15 minutes in. No, I mean, I want people to understand that I've been waiting for this hearing forever. I've been waiting to see Asia testify forever. And when Vignaraja did that, to me, it was so, I mean, it was just a clear malicious move, because there's no way he was going to call me. I don't know. There's no reason for him to call me. I had nothing of substance to offer for this particular hearing.
Well, joke's on him, because you were way more effective from the outside than you were in, because you could tweet like crazy and talk
to
everyone.
True. So inside the courthouse, you couldn't have your phone out. You couldn't be on social media. I just went across the street. Now, you know, and many, many loving people sent over dozens of donuts, and I had lots of visitors, and I spent 5 days in Dunkin' Donuts, and it was fine. It was cool. The documentary then moves from 2016 all the way back to 2000. And the second trial we were shown?
We've seen clips of both trials, so I forget which one is which. You can see the dates below.
It's hard to tell, but I think it was the second trial. And we see Detective Ritz taking the stand.
Yeah, so Detective Ritz is testifying about this interview that he did with Jay Wilds. This is, of course, Jay's first recorded interview on February 28th, 1999.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Today's date is the 28th of February. For this record, could you please state your full name?
J.W. Wild.
And, you know, immediately we're taken back to Surreal and this whole idea of Jay as the unreliable narrator. And a big part of this episode is sort of unpacking these inconsistencies about where the trunk pop happened and where Jen and he met up after the alleged Linkin Park pings. And we can already start to see how these things aren't adding up in Jay's story.
Yeah, so and they use a visual, this graphic of a timeline, which I thought was great to do. But I even as somebody who knows the case inside and out, it's still not easy to follow everything that's going on and understand the significance of the dates here. So February 28th, 1999 is the first official recorded interview that we know police had with Jay. That was late at night. And then early that morning, Jay allegedly took them to find the car, and then they went immediately to go arrest Adnan, like in the early morning hours, like around dawn. The timeline that's set out by the state at the time of the proceedings and in this documentary what they're trying to show is that the police apparently first talked to Jen, and then they went to Jay. So this was kind of interesting, and I think it's important to explain to our listeners like why any of this matters, whether it matters that the police went looking for Jay and just came across Jen, or whether they went looking for Jen deliberately.
So technically what the cops should have known at that time period is that there were phone calls between Anand's phone and a number that belonged to the Pusateri's home residence. So if they're looking for Jen specifically, why? Yeah, they can make an informed guess that it's possibly Jen who was on the phone, but they would not have known that unless they'd known more of the story or had some inkling of what they were looking for.
What the state says is that, you know, that Jen was first spoken to on the 27th, and then Jen kind of led them to Jay, which we know now that is probably unlikely because of other information that was introduced in this documentary that came from the defense investigator.
Yeah, so Jay, as we know, had this job at Southwestern Video, this adult video store, and I guess, you know, in this case, he had his boss, Sis, and she was interviewed by the defense PI. And what she says in the memo written up by the PI is that there are various occasions before February 28th when he missed work because he was speaking to the police officers. And so that fundamentally contradicts the narrative that they didn't even know about Jay until talking to Jen and didn't interview Jay until February 28th.
Of course, the documentary's investigators did try and talk to her. She's still around, the Sis. And she did not recall ever being interviewed by anyone about this case, which is interesting because we now have two options. Either, I mean, she did and her memory is just gone, or is it possible that the investigator that Gutierrez hired was like writing false reports of investigation? I don't think so. I don't know anything about Drew Davis that may lead me to think that. But we also know Davis, according to his own report, spoke to the CIS multiple times. It wasn't like one quick interview. He went back to her at least once to ask about Mr. S. They wanted to know if it was possible that possibly Jay had known Alonzo Sellers from Alonzo Sellers going to the quarter booths at the weird store there. What are you even calling that store? The porn store? The
Well, we learned they have the booths, right?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with this world.
Yeah, quarter booths there, so it seems a bit more than just a video store.
You know what? I didn't want to Google that. I don't know what it is, and I don't want to know.
Yeah, well, anyway, what we do know from the notes is, so we have a choice here. Either, unfortunately, Sis cannot recall now when she talks to investigators, or this did happen, and it's pretty crucial, and we have no other way of knowing about it. Because Drew Davis, at least in one respect, did fail as an investigator, and that he didn't even try and get her to confirm from work records what day was missed.
Now, we also have, not in the documentary yet, but the investigators have come out and said that Sis didn't remember Jay by name or description, so she didn't remember Jay. That makes us think that either she's being dishonest or has pretty bad memory overall, and it would be...
Jay didn't work there very long, though.
It's true. He wasn't there that long, but...
But can I tell you guys something? There's some of us, if you ask me, I went to law school for 4 years, 3.5 years, excuse me. I don't remember the name of a single professor. Like, there's some of us who just have really bad memories, and I am one of those people. So I can see that. And for me, it's such a stretch that Davis, the investigator, would craft anything on his own, because he would be working in the dark. He wouldn't know what to even make
up.
Like, how would he know when they spoke to... But it also makes sense that this is how it went down, because Adnan's phone records, the very first call that day is to Jay. It's not to Jen. It doesn't make sense for the police to go to Jen first. It makes sense. Also, I think Jay and his family or somebody the police are more familiar with. For me, why that's significant is that, I mean, like, what I believe has happened is that the police just kept wanting to see. And, you know, there are times, I remember, was it the Intercept interview where Jay said, they kept harassing me, they kept coming around?
Yeah.
Which kind of fits this narrative. I think what happened was the police were just trying to kind of corner him, talk him into this, you know, get him to agree to do this. And then maybe he was like, well, maybe Jen can back me up to some extent. So, because otherwise... It didn't sound like he was very surprised when Jen came to him. I think he expected it.
Just tell them the truth and like, really? If that's the case, why wouldn't you go to the police yourself? Like, if you're telling Jen to just tell the truth, the thing is, he lied to her. So he wanted her to lie to the police, obviously.
I guess it was about 2 weeks before the first trial when I found out that he had helped Adnan bury her body in the woods. And he really did know where the body was. And I feel like... If we would have known that, or if I would have known that, we might have done something different. I don't know.
And there's so much that's wrong there. And we also hear Jen say in the documentary, she's like, you'd think from the questions they were asking me that I already talked to someone.
One of the things I thought it was interesting that what she said was when she was asked, well, why didn't you go to the police when Jay's telling you about this? And she's like, well, we didn't think we had any pertinent information. He saw a body in the trunk of a car. I mean, that's not pertinent information.
That's the same answer she gave back then, too. And she's like, well, we didn't have any proof of anything. I'm like, you don't need proof. You just got to report what you saw. That's one thing that leads me back to wondering, like, how much they considered this real at the time. If Jen just believed the story that they're piecing together themselves, like speculation they came up with on their own, well, yeah, they wouldn't go to the police. They're just speculating. If they actually had seen things, though, or Jay had actually seen things, then her answer makes much less sense.
Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done. ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications roll in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
One thing I thought was interesting in this is also the information around Best Buy. Like, do you know where it happened? How do you know where it happened? And she said at first, Jay didn't know where it happened, but then later she found, and he also didn't know where the body was, but later she found out that he did know and that he had helped bury the body. One of the things about Best Buy that does not come up in the episode is that, and we've talked about this on Undisclosed before, but when Jay is asked at some point about why he initially doesn't tell them that it happened at Best Buy, the police, he says something to, because there were cameras and I didn't want to be associated. Do you remember that whole conversation?
So there's like a few like lies that the prosecutor and the detectives were pretty concerned about during that first interview. There were a lot of lies, but there were a few in particular that really worried them. And they definitely tried to go through and rehabilitate Jay in that second interview, try and correct him. The one they can never fix is the one about why Jay lied about it not being at Best Buy. Because his answer is just nonsensical. Like for the Christy Vinson thing, his answer is, oh, I didn't want to get her involved. That's why I didn't bring her up before. So they move on to the next one. And they get to the whole Best Buy thing, and he just can't come up with an answer that makes sense to explain why he lied about it.
One thing they do talk about here is that he originally, it's in the interview. He says that he met Adnan at Edmondson Avenue. So that's the first trunk pop. Then we hear from Chris. Now, Chris is somebody I have not. Was Chris actually in Serial? Did we hear from him?
No, he was interviewed, but we have not seen him before.
Okay,
I haven't Baskerville, seen him. I've wondered about him. Even from Serial, I've wondered about him because when you get to the transcripts of Jay's interviews with the detectives, I mean, Chris Baskerville is the dude he names that can also corroborate his whole story along with Jen. So they do talk to Jen. Why don't they talk to Baskerville? I mean, if they had, they'd learn that Jay was telling a totally different story to him, but they never even try. And I just can't, it's hard for me to understand why the police did not talk to Baskerville unless they somehow knew or were afraid that his story was not going to gel with what they were trying to put together.
That's what I think. Sometime off tape, I think Jay told them, I said this pool hall story to Chris. They didn't want bad evidence. They decided not to pursue him. That's my guess.
It could be that because of the inconsistency there, or it could just be for the same reason that I think they didn't, you know, Jay is telling them that this is when, you know, that I dumped these shovels at Westview Mall. But what we know is the police don't go for like, what, another month or I don't know how long, like a month after, like sometime in April or 2 months later that they go to look at the dumpsters. They don't even try to retrieve anything for a couple of months. And to me, that's just an indication that they don't believe them anyways.
They were probably already gone. It's a dumpster. That's what they do.
But why would they wait 2 months to even look at it?
Because they'd already waited a month and a half before they knew about it. Yes, technically they should have gone right away, but also, I'm going to give them, this is the one thing I'll give them some leeway on because the dumpster wouldn't dump by then.
Maybe. Well, to me, it's always, look, it's like kind of like, well, why didn't they get the phone booth records from Best Buy? I mean, like, there's always
that they should have done.
Right. There's always, there's a reason they did certain things and there are reasons they didn't do certain things. And I think we know what those are. So let's talk a little bit about, we see Philip Budemeyer in this episode, and he was a city surveyor who was asked to come on the day that Alonzo Sellers, you know, allegedly found the body. And kind of measure the distance back. And they ask him on film, like, why were you asked to do that? And he said, you know, kind of determine the location of the body to be able to place it in the park, I guess, you know, to have that on record. But what he kind of brings of significance to this is bringing more skepticism to the seller's story about how he found the body.
You can just hold, just right here, just lift that up high.
Got it.
To avoid all that brush.
Okay.
I see the log.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Budemeyer has always maintained and maintains again here that this is a really difficult body to see the way it was there in Lincoln Park. It was mostly covered by leaves. And you really, according to him, would have to be looking for this body to see it. He certainly didn't. And that's the main point he's always driven home and is driving home again here is this almost certainly was not an accidental discovery that Alonzo Sellers, Mr. S here, was looking for this body or been given information it was in this general area.
Which leads me to the next point, which is they actually show crime scene photographs of the body. And I was pretty jarred by that. I didn't expect it. I didn't know they were going to do it. And frankly, I didn't like seeing it.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen the photos before.
I've seen them.
I guess I thought they'd lost their emotional impact, but I mean, it doesn't.
I mean, all three of us have seen, we've all seen these photographs before, but to me, I was like, why, I don't know. I felt a sense of protectiveness for Hay. I didn't want the world to see her like that, I guess is how I felt. I was very, very, every time one of those images came up, I was just like, God dang. Like, I didn't want to.
On the other hand, though, I mean, the thing part of this case is that matters.
It matters.
Like, a lot.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask
that
you guys. Do you think it was important to show it?
Yeah. You can debate that till the end of time. People have different judgments on it. End of the day, it was evidence, and it is now critical evidence. And there's ways around it, I guess. I mean, like, you could do what I did, only in better form, and, like, do some kind of recreation. But at the end of the day, the best evidence is those photos.
Yeah, well, you know, to your point, Rabia, I'm not sure this was necessary, but I also don't know exactly where they're going in episodes 3 and 4. So I know they had you on camera in episode 2 discussing the lividity. And these photos, of course, are critical in terms of establishing lividity and contradicting Jay's story. But at least at this point, I didn't see a need for them being shown. And again, I'll sort of wait and see if that comes up later.
Yeah, there is a lot. So this is the first time I've watched them after seeing the others. There was a lot in there that was definitely setting up very clear references to future stuff that's covered, which obviously first time through, I didn't notice at all. Yeah, watching it again, you can really see like some of the stuff that sends like throwaway comments or like quick asides. That is a setup.
I will say, I feel like this is the kind of series that everybody's going to have to watch a few times, you know.
I have to, like, so much because they cram so much information in, especially because they have the dual sort of focus of what's being said on camera and what's being shown in the screen. Often you'll see like there's this extra important details that they don't elaborate in dialogue, but they are there as like a sort of a source that you can instantly check and see. But yeah, it takes multiple viewings to catch it all.
Well, like, you know, you mentioned Chris a minute ago and he makes the comment toward the end of the episode where he's like, you know, if Jay and you are in a car and he might be implicated, he's going to try to put the blame on you. He'll try to trade places with you in a heartbeat. And he says, this is why people don't talk to Jay anymore. You know, presumably that's coming from some real world examples where he can show Jay was at fault and shifted blame. I'd be really interested to hear if they have some more footage to go into some more depth on that.
Yeah. In my notes, I have a Baskerville, like Arrow, speaking from experience. ? Like, sounds like there's a story there.
Oh, there's definitely a story. I mean, his face, too. His facial expressions were like, oh,
yeah.
Man, do I have shit to say? Do I have stuff to tell?
And really, it was kind of at odds with his voice. Like, his voice was not, it was a little bit like, you know, Jay, look what he does, kind of, you know, insinuating there's that story. But, like, his expressions definitely brought home the fact that, yeah, at some point in his life, he got screwed by Jay.
All right, so another Chris appears in this episode, and that is attorney Chris Floor. I have to say, I was giggling, but also I was like, why do they show him brushing his hair? I don't know why.
That's the worst part of, like, being on the other side of the documentary or being on the other side of the show. Like, when you have no idea what they're going to use. Like, they're filming you all day.
I know.
And you never know what they're going to decide to keep, what they're not.
I mean, it is a glorious mane. Chris, we love you. We love your hair.
He, like, admits, like, my family doesn't like it.
I think recently he's chopped it off, but
it's a defense attorney thing. I mean, a lot of defense attorneys do that.
What? Grow their hair out?
Long hair. Yeah.
It is?
Yeah.
I did not know this. Okay. I wonder why. That's kind of odd. They don't get the time.
I mean, it's more to, I guess, to, I mean, one theory is that, like, it's to make sure that you can identify more with your clients and show them that, you know, you're a little bit edgy. You're not part of the establishment. You're not the man.
Oh, I never thought of Chris Floor as edgy. He's like one of the sweetest teddy bears I've ever met, but he's a sweet guy. So, but he's telling us a story that's pretty disturbing. He talks about the day that Adnan is arrested. So again, you know, February 28th, that's the morning that Adnan is arrested, early morning hours, and the family contacts an attorney and tries to get the attorney to get down there. They've got their 17-year-old son, been taken away by the police. We hear Adnan talking about that morning and that, you know, they read him his Miranda, and I think it didn't click until he saw the charging sheet, and then he was like, I need a lawyer.
When I was initially arrested, they had me initial a Miranda sheet. They didn't register with me at all, and they put the paper in front of me, the Metro Crime Stopper paper. They had Hayes' picture. The first detective, Ritz, he was saying, hey, man, look, why did you do it? Da, 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 why did you do it? And McGillivray said, hey, man, just tell us the truth. Did you get mad? Because, look, I had an ex-wife. I get mad at her sometimes.
And he said, they asked him, do you have a lawyer? He's like, no, but, you know, I want a lawyer. Like, basically, he's not going to talk anymore. So what we know is that his interrogation or whatever, the police questioning, was not recorded as far as we know. We have no evidence that it was taped. But we have documentation of it. And I think it's like one page of notes, right?
It's barely even one page. It's like two or three lines. I mean, if you, those of you who listened to season three of Undisclosed, think back to the interrogation of Dennis Perry. It is very likely they were doing the same thing there, same read technique, where they're going to make sure they have a non-confessing and then rehearse the confession and then record it. So they weren't going to record till, like, not even the first confession, but until they knew what the confession would be. And they never got that far, obviously. So there was never a recording. But he was interrogated for hours, many hours.
Right. But Chris Flohr showed up fairly early in the morning. It's not like he showed up 8 hours later. He showed up fairly early. I think it was around 7 or 8 in the morning is when Chris showed up to see his client. And they didn't let him in.
Because apparently the new rule is not only do you have to ask for an attorney, you have to ask for the attorney by name.
Is that a rule, Colin? Isn't that
No, it's not a rule. Now, if you just have the attorney coming and the individual, the suspect in the case, is not asking to speak to an attorney, that's true. They have no obligation to allow the attorney in. But if you have an attorney there and the suspect is asking to speak to an attorney, they don't have to reference their specific name. That attorney is there. They've requested the attorney. They have to cease the interrogation and then allow them to speak to the attorney.
And that's the constitutional, I mean, that's his constitutional right to have an attorney present. And he's being denied that as a juvenile. But I know that Chris went on throughout the day to like send multiple letters and via fax, I think, to the police station. Again, like saying that I was there, you didn't let me in. But I don't know when he actually gets to see Adnan for the first time. They don't talk about that in the documentary. And I kind of don't remember, frankly.
Probably after his booking.
After he's booked. Okay. All right. So as all this is happening, Adnan's been arrested. There is probably utter chaos with his friends. And it's, you know, they show footage of a few students who just can't believe that Adnan has been arrested. They don't think he did it. They are confused.
Once Adnan was arrested, a bunch of us went, you know, 3 or 4 of us went to the principal's office and we, you know, demanded to speak with the police and they had the wrong person.
I remember me and Krista going to the principal's office. The cops told us that they found DNA evidence that linked him to her body.
And Laura and Krista in the documentary say that, you know, they went to the principal's office because they're like, what is happening? And they are told there, number one, that there is DNA evidence that is implicating Adnan. Now, that is something that we've been told by multiple sources, that the police told them that. The police told teachers and the principal and students that we have DNA evidence linking him to the crime. And that was a complete and utter lie.
And how much you want to bet they told Jay that, too?
You know what? They probably did. I do think that Jay probably believes it. But another thing Krista remembers is that she remembers some teacher saying that this is also like some kind of a Muslim thing, which is, you know, what the state's motive was anyhow, their theory of the crime anyway. Now, Hope Shab never came out and said that. I don't think she came out and ever said that on the stand or even like I've never heard that thing from her. But this, it's interesting to me that this is already circulating. I feel like that had to come also from the police.
I mean, it didn't have to. Let's be real. You know that. I'm sure that there were plenty of people that could come up with, you know, that kind of racism on their own.
I mean, I'm guessing if the police are saying, because, you know, this is so common. I see this online all the time. You know, people are like, well, what's the motive? Well, what's the motive? And I can see the police saying, well, the motive was that, you know, it's a Muslim honor killing or whatever. Because they already had, at that point, and actually I want to talk about this quickly. When Detective Massey says in the first episode that, you know, we started really looking at Adnan with that phone call, that's not true. They had already begun looking at Adnan before that because we know they pulled his records and stuff before that, his driving records and whatever else. And to me, the only reason they would have done that was because they already had this cultural consultant. I mean, in their minds, they were setting up the story already because that this is a Muslim thing. For these students and these teachers, they see Adnan. Are they really seeing him as like a Muslim fundamentalist in their school? This guy's like prom king and dating and he's like life of the party. I can't imagine for a second that that's how the perspective they had about him.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe. I don't know. I'm just...
Yeah. Then we get to Asia.
Yeah. Well, we saw Asia in... I'm pretty sure that's the actual Woodlawn Library.
Was it really?
Isn't it? I have no idea. I'm making that up.
I can't tell.
I assumed it was. I'm like, wait, is it? And she's talking about just how all this came to be and how she came to remember her story.
I told him that I heard that they had broken up. He told me that it was true. He said that she had started a new relationship with another guy. He referred to him as a white dude, is what he said. You know, I kind of felt bad for prying. He just kind of shrugged it off and he said, you know, I just want her to be happy.
I mean, it's such a teen, like the way she describes it is just so teenage, and like her motivations and actions, like, all make sense from that lens. I mean, she's a woman now, and she's as an adult looking back trying to describe what she was doing then. But like looking at her letters, you remember that they're kids. And she's talking about how when her ex-boyfriend, Justin, he's the one who's like, when she tells him, hey, I saw Adnan just before Hay went missing. And he immediately takes her over to Adnan's family, thinking like, okay, let's go tell them, and this will get all like, you know, fixed quickly once we can let them know what Asia saw. And of course, no one there has any ability to comprehend what's being said, to understand how it could be important. No one at this time knows when the murder was. In fact, all the news reports suggest the murder was after 3. If someone was trying to fake an alibi, they would fake it for after 3, which is when the news reports say that she was seen driving away from the school. So the fact Asia is going and saying like, hey, I think I saw Adnan from like 2:20, 2:40, and probably everyone around her is like, okay, big whoop. Hay was alive then. She wasn't dead till 3 anyway.
Yeah. And that's where Debbie is so important here, is that, you know, Debbie is this clean cut honors student at Woodlawn. She makes this police statement saying, I saw Hay at 3 o'clock at the school. And that was the common knowledge around. And so, of course, the family is not going to think this alibi that goes to 2:40 is important. And I think that's a big part of, potentially, we don't know exactly with Gutierrez, but I think that she might very well have disregarded it as unimportant because everyone thought going into trial, it was going to be this dead after 3 o'clock timeline.
Yeah, because remember in the disclosures from the prosecutor, Kevin Urich, he says like, oh, the victim died shortly after leaving school, which is a vague way of not explaining actually you think she left earlier. So Gutierrez, I mean, it doesn't matter. She should have checked into Asia, obviously, anyway. But she, to be fair, at that point, did not have any concrete reason to think that the time before 3 p.m. mattered at all.
At least not until the second trial.
Yeah. After the first trial, at that point, she should have been like, well, dude, I have a witness saying that she saw my client at this time, and no one ever told me that this was the time that we were concerned about. So,
right.
That's the thing. Like, oh my God. Yeah, it's just so frustrating. But why would Asia be lying about that when it wouldn't even matter? And why would Gutierrez have thought Asia was lying when, as far as she knows, this girl is offering up a useless alibi?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, like, when it comes to Asia, you know, there is the issue that there might have been reasons that she didn't contact her initially, but after this first trial, she should have known better. But even then, part of the problem is that she told Adnan that she did. She said, I did check it out, and she lied on that. And so there's a couple different issues there. But anyway, Asia starts talking a little bit about why she doesn't go to the police. And she wrote Adnan a couple of letters at the time. She read from those letters in the documentary. And then she's asked, well, why didn't you go to the police? In one of the letters, she says, I haven't talked to the police yet. She tells Adnan that.
Yeah. Underlined 3 times.
Almost like a threat or a promise, or I don't know what it was. But anyway, and I thought it was interesting that Asia also, you know, I mean, she experienced Baltimore in the 90s vis-a-vis the police the same way a lot of Black people living in that neighborhood did. And she said that, you know, the police would harass her. They would stop her for no reason. She didn't trust them. And then we see some footage about how the police were operating at the time and really kind of still do. And they said something about how the Baltimore City police they had one of the highest clearance rates in the country.
And guess who had the highest among the police, basically? Detective Ritz.
Is that right?
Yeah. He had a ridiculously high clear rate, even among Baltimore standards. And by the way, clearing does not mean having a conviction. Clearing means they made an arrest.
They made an arrest. So they've closed their case in a way. Okay.
No one really has time to go to the post office. You're busy. I'm busy. I'm working on Undisclosed. I'm teaching classes at the law school. I'm writing multiple briefs to the Supreme Court. I'm working on legislation in several states. That's why Stamps.com is so great. Stamps.com brings all the amazing services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your computer. Whether you're a small office sending invoices, an online seller shipping out products, or even a warehouse sending thousands of packages a day, Stamps.com can handle it all with ease. Simply use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you need to send. Once your mail is ready, just hand it to your mail carrier or drop it in a mailbox. It's that simple. With Stamps.com, you get 5 cents off every first-class stamp and up to 40% off priority mail. Not to mention, it's a fraction of the cost of those expensive postage meters. Stamps.com is a no-brainer, saving you time and money. It's no wonder over 700,000 small businesses already use Stamps.com. And right now, my listeners get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a digital scale, all without any long-term commitment. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com, enter undisclosed.
So Detective Massey's back in this episode. Again, he is there to... I still think it's because the dude wants attention. And that's why he's the only Baltimore detective willing to go on the record. But his answer is like, oh my God, that same sort of vibe of like self-awareness. And that's, I know it's not the right word for it, but like that's how I'm going to describe it. Continues in this episode too. And there's one point where he is asked about if Jay could have been interviewed before the official interview. And his answer was something like, I can't confirm or deny it either way.
Right.
I'm like, what is that about?
Because he even if he doesn't know the details of this case, he probably knows that this is how they operate. Like just because
if this is not something that happens in Baltimore police, he should say no, it didn't happen.
Right.
He cannot say no, it didn't happen because he knows things like that do at times happen.
Okay, something somebody said to me just a couple of days ago was, gosh, you know, it was such a weird coincidence or so unlucky for Adnan that Jay happened to have the car and the phone that day. And then Jay becomes state, and they were able to pressure Jay. Now, part of that is kind of true, but I think
it was unlucky.
It was unlucky. But the other thing I think is that the police obviously didn't initially realize that Jay had Adnan's phone and car. I think the police really thought Adnan did it. He had his phone, his car, and they would have had a whole different theory of how he murdered her. They did, right?
The first interview, like they go in talking to Jay, and they still, at that point, to me, it's clear they still believe that Adnan had the phone. And that's a big reason they have to go fix everything and have a second interview with Jay.
Right. So they don't even realize. And I think in the first interview, Jay says that Adnan left the phone in the car. And this is kind of an important point because leaving the phone in the glove compartment, which is what he would have done because you couldn't take him into the schools, is different than him saying, I'm giving you this device so that I can call you after I kill somebody, which is how they, you know, went after him for first degree murder, premeditation. They said that was premeditated. But in this interview, and I think it's not the only time that Jay actually does say, you know, he just kind of left it.
Yeah. The phone was actually not part of the murder plot, according to Jay. The phone just happened to be in the car. Jay technically never had permission to use it.
I mean, I'm trying to understand, like, if somebody, like, what do you think the benefit of somebody who's actually planning a murder like this would be to actually give away his phone and car to somebody else to commit the murder versus just maybe following the victim in their car? And why do they think that would be like that would be the plan that Adnan would come up with? And it's not just a plan he came up with, but it's like on the fly, on the day of, hey, by the way, I'm going to do this today. Keep my phone and car and I'll call you afterwards. That Adnan thought that Jay would go along with it, that this would all work out. I mean, I don't understand why they thought that would be like a rational...
Because it had to be that way. It had to be that way. Otherwise, there's no story for them to use.
They didn't have a choice.
Yeah, so that has to be the story, flat out.
Now, one thing I hope listeners caught during this episode was Jay, in this interview, also talks about when Adnan called him when he's at Jen's house and when he left. And Jen also, we see Jen testifying to the same thing. Both of them, once again, say that he was at her house till about 3:45 p.m.
I remember the phone call. I remember him leaving.
Do you remember when that was?
Between 3:30, 3:45.
How do you circle the square?
Because that's actually what happened.
Why do you think they won't move from this? They'll lie about, they'll make up anything about everything. Every time Jay is told to like change his story, he does it, but he won't budge from this. Why?
I mean, there's some things that he doesn't budge for. It's not really a fixed story. Like he doesn't know, I mean, at this point he might, but like if you don't really know the timeline, why would you know how important it is to change that detail?
Of course he knows the timeline. I mean, the phone records are right in front of him.
Yeah, but like piecing it all together, trying to make understand what's going on. Jen says is the one saying the 3:45 to 4 or even later thing. Jay does bring his story back down in line with the phone records. He's often confused about details and gets mixed up again and like goes back to stories, but he does flip around a bit. Jen's the one who like never says 2:30s when he left.
But at trial, Jay testifies that he is at her house till about 3:40, 3:45.
But then he goes, they get the phone records and they says like, oh, I mean, he's testifying off the phone records. So I would say it's more an example of his confusion and his like inability to recall because it's the story as opposed to him fixing to this point.
All right. Then there's the documentary highlights the discrepancy between where Jen apparently picked Jay up. Jay always says that Adnan dropped him off at home and Jen picked him up from there. And Jen has, nope, it was at Westview.
And this is something Jay's story has never changed on either.
Yeah.
Like, this is the part that drives me crazy. Jen is supposed to the corroborating evidence that proves Jay's story.
Yeah, why wouldn't he change that?
And yet the part that matters, they can't freaking agree on. How can Jen corroborate a story that Jay doesn't tell?
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, Jay in his Intercept interview says, I lied about certain things like saying the trunk pop was the Best Buy because I wanted to protect my family and my grandma. But here, if we believe Jen, then Jay is actually lying and saying that Jen got me at this house as opposed to the mall. So that doesn't make sense. And it's not just the location, because Jen is saying, I saw both Jay and Adnan. And of course, in Jay's story, Adnan has dropped him off. So it's not just location, it's who's actually there at this meeting time between Jay and Jen.
Also, Jay and Jen at various points have this weird detail about the 7-Eleven. They did include it in the documentary.
Oh, right.
I've never understood what it's about, but like they keep like...
Jen says it. Jen does say it. She says we went to 7-Eleven.
And so does Jay too.
Yeah.
They just go to 7-Eleven and have a smoke or something. I don't even know. And then it falls out of the story later on.
And the documentary, at least in this episode, doesn't get into it, but that's just the start of the discrepancies. Their entire accountings of what happens the rest of that night, as well as the next morning, are completely divergent.
All right, so then now we see Christy Vinson. And Christy Vinson is not her real name, Kathy, as we know her from Serial, just to kind of connect the dots here.
Amy would like tell me not to say not her real name, Kathy, at times. I'd like slip up and call her Kathy, and they're like, no, her name's Christy. I'm like, you're right, sorry.
Right. And Christy appears a couple times in the story. The first time is when she says that she was with Jen the night that the police came looking for her by name. That she was with her that night. And for some reason, when she was there and the police were like, we want to talk to you about this homicide, we're from homicide, she immediately kind of made some connection to, she said, this must be about the night that Jay and Adnan came over. And I thought that was weird. Like, why would she think that if she knows, unless she has, why would she think any of that's connected to a homicide? You know, for Jay and Adnan to come over that night, why would you think anything that happened that night is connected to a murder?
I guess if you have no other sketchy friends or no one else you've met has ever been sketchy at all, that might be the first thing to go to. It is strange. It makes me wonder if perhaps they've been talking about that or talking about Adnan or talking about this guy. And that's why it's standing out in Christy's memory. But it's hard to say.
Yeah, because that's a heck of a leap to make. I mean, I don't believe for a second that Jay and Adnan are the shadiest people that, for example,
I know
that Jen knows. I mean, we know Jen. I mean, like
we know that we know is plenty more shady people.
Yes, yeah, there are plenty more shady people that Jen knows. So if Christy's like, well, who is Jen connected to that could be involved in the murder? I don't know why she'd leap to. But I do wonder if Jen has already said something to her at that point, which means Jen knows something from before the police coming to talk to her.
Remember, there are times after the murder that Adnan's cell phone was used to call Christy, presumably by Jay. We don't actually know. It's possible there was some kind of further contact between them.
All right. Well, so they try to establish now the second point of contact here between Christy and the actual, you know, whatever the story, the crime, is that Christy is one of the people who testifies for the state, saying that she remembers on the day of Heyman Lee's disappearance that Adnan and Jay came over briefly. And what she says in the documentary lines up with what she testified to 20 years ago. She says that Jay came in with this guy. She didn't know this guy. He didn't say a word, but it was Adnan. She identified him later. He only said a couple of things. He said, how do you get rid of a high? And then later he got a phone call and he responded like, well, what am I supposed to say to them? And she didn't know what it was about. And then they left abruptly. And she's been pretty consistent about that. She knows the time of day they came because of Judge Judy playing at the time. Her story seems to be kind of all lined up. I don't think there's any discrepancies here in those stories, right?
I mean, her story has always been basically consistent. It's not consistent with everyone else's stories, but what she says, I mean, with you know, a few exceptions, they're inevitable, like some small shifts and drifts in her story, but nothing at all that would make me suggest that makes sure she's lying. Her story has been the same. The problem is it just doesn't match what everyone else says. Like, for instance, that phone call. Christy has always been like, she describes it as like talking to a friend, she thought. What Jay says that phone call was the police calling him to ask about Hay, and Christy never heard that, so yeah.
Well, he wouldn't be saying that to the police. He wouldn't say to the police, what do I say to them? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. There's no phone call that exists that we know of that could account for what Christy heard.
At least for the 13th. For the 13th.
Yeah.
Which is actually going to be my...
No, in the time period, yeah.
The phone records themselves, and I know how the cell phone towers don't tell you exactly where it is. But why do you think Christy's narrative is important here? Does it help corroborate what the state is trying to show with the cell phone evidence?
Yeah. I mean, that's their other call. Like, the calls they use to show, the only calls they use from that day to show location at trial are the calls supposedly at Christy's house and the calls in Lincoln Park, because those are the ones, they're all incoming calls, and they're calls they can get Jay to testify to that supposedly match the cell phone records to you know, his story, but they don't even try for every other call because it's so far off.
So, okay, one thing that Massey says when he talks about Jay, and it's really kind of what everybody said. You know, I remember in Serial, Sarah Koenig said, what about the Nisha call? For her, the Nisha call was, there was no explanation for the Nisha call other than Adnan and Jay were together at the time, and which to her, that's really incriminating. But what Massey says is, it was the fact that Jay knew where the car was. And so we now start moving into issues around the car. Now, I remember, Susan, the first time, I mean, I think you were the first one to point out the grass under the car and the grass in the wheel well of the car, which is actually something the documentary doesn't talk about.
I think that was Reddit. I can't remember at this point. What? But yeah, that thing came out pretty early on. We saw the photos and we're like, why is the grass under it still green?
Yeah, there's very distinct spots, two very distinct spots, like on the left and right side of the car of Hayes.
You mean actually, sorry, there's two kinds of grass we're talking about here. The grass actually on the car, like tires, and the grass that's still growing underneath.
Right. Well, this episode doesn't, well, they started going into the grass. I guess we're going to find out later what's his name? Eric
Irvin? Scientist.
Right. The turf physiologist.
The turf scientist.
The turf scientist. Very cool. In the photographs, you see two very distinct spots next to Hayes' car on the left and right where it's clear that cars have been standing over the grass for a long time, and they're these big brown rectangle patches. But you don't see that under Hayes' car. It almost looks like Hayes' car has been squeezed between these two cars on a patch of grass fairly recently. Couldn't have been there too long. And they actually find a resident who's been living there 45 years. And I always thought this. I thought, you know, I know that kind of community. That's the kind of community where people live there for decades, and there's generations, and they know each other. And, you know, they also briefly in the documentary show, like, all the different, like, calls the police get for, you know, crimes in the areas, and including car-related crimes. Now, that car, according to the state narrative, sat there for 6 weeks in the winter. It's pretty clean, with no lock on it, no lock on the steering wheel, nothing's
been stripped. When every other car in that photo has, like, the club on it.
Yeah, this is back in the day when everybody had the club. But yeah, every car, if you look closely in all the other photographs, has a club on it. And that car has been untouched for 6 weeks in a very high crime area. Also an area that is heavily policed. That's part of why I'm very, very skeptical that the car was there for 6 weeks. And I can't wait to see what the documentary determines on that.
Well, that neighbor's skeptical too, because, well, one, she can confirm ain't nobody's going to resaw that, like, back alley over there. And also that, yeah, they would have noticed if that car had been sitting there because, I mean, that's the kind of people they are.
So what if there was a car that had been parked there by someone and left for 6 weeks?
It would not have sat no 6 to 8 weeks without any one of us, Jean or I, finding out why was it still there. We would call 311 and tell them about a car. It's none of the neighbors around.
And what would the city do?
They would come out and even check it out, tag it, you know, tow truck them, tow them away.
Yeah, she said she and her friend were kind of busybodies, and this is, you know, as point of reference, these were row houses that backed up to this grassy area where it seems people parked their cars during the day and then left during the night. And her point is, you know, I would look back there, and if this car is sitting there, the same car in the same spot for 6 weeks, I'm calling 311, the city would have come, they would have tagged it, they would have towed it away. And of course, that's, you know, not 100% certainty that that would have happened, but you know, she certainly seemed like the type of person who would have noticed this and would have done something about it.
So the documentary gets into something that I can't remember. Did we talk about Undisclosed or not? I know we had some debates about this, but it gets into Jay's criminal record. It focuses very specifically on one terrible incident in which he hit, beat, punched his now ex-girlfriend pretty badly while she's in a vehicle with her child in the car. And that ex-girlfriend, her name is Nikisha. But before we talk about Nikisha, I want to talk a little bit about this criminal record and the fact that, as far as we know, Jay's actually never spent any time in prison for any of these incidents.
Did you see the reference on that wall to Stabbed by Will?
What?
Do y'all remember what that's
about? I didn't see that.
I don't recall what that's about, do y'all?
He stabbed somebody? Is that what that said?
Or was stabbed? I think it just said stabbed by Will.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, it's highly unusual, right? That, like, you know, he's...
That's the one I can't understand.
Right, resisting arrest.
That's the one he's body slamming cops. That's the one I keep, that I have no explanation for. It is very common in Baltimore to see cases that get steaded after being charged and to have, you know, even, I mean, Jay does have more than usual, that's for sure. But it's not uncommon in itself for someone to have a few of those. It's just the time when he assaulted the cops, I cannot explain.
And so 2 points on that. So first, for listeners, this is known as the Stett docket in Baltimore. And essentially what it means is you've been charged with something. We place it on the stet docket, which is the opposite of the active docket where you're going to be prosecuted. And basically, if you keep your nose clean for a certain period of time, then that charge against you gets dismissed. And then second, Rabia, you know, you mentioned the story on Serial about the person who Jay was trying to stab. Well, that's Chris. That's Chris who appears in this episode.
That's right.
The one who tells that story on Serial.
Maybe that explains a lot. Okay, Chris's face.
There are lots of reasons people don't talk to Jay anymore.
So, yeah, so one of the cases that ends up in the stet docket is this domestic violence case. I'm astonished. Okay, there might be a lot of cases that are put on that docket, Susan, but not something like this violent.
Not that
I mean,
one.
The photograph, her photographs, she was hurt pretty badly.
Well, no, so domestic violence, I'd say, is probably what common.
When you have this kind of evidence, I haven't seen that. I haven't seen it with this kind of evidence. She has, clearly, she's been battered. Her face has been battered. I have seen it in cases where it's not as easy to determine, maybe, but can you imagine her as a victim? Like, that nothing happens to this guy?
And the child was in the car.
He attacked cops and got away with it, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Do we know who the prosecutor was on? Like, how does that get, who decides to put it on stet? I mean, is Urich still involved here?
No, what's going on? It'll be some prosecutor. I think we probably have a name somewhere, but it's not someone I can recall offhand.
So what do we think? What's going on here? Is he a confidential informant? Why is he so untouchable?
You know, it's hard to imagine even like a CI could get away with what Jay did. I just don't know. I don't think we can answer that. It makes no sense. I mean, it's bizarre, and it does show that Jay is very good at getting away with things.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Nikisha. Now, I'm a little worried about her being on screen. I'm worried for her. I think it's brave of her to be involved in this documentary. I've never had contact with her. I feel like with her history and him and the fact that she's still in contact, and they have a child together, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seems so risky for her to do this.
She's taking a risk and she knows it, but she wants to do it. Like, she's very, I mean, I've met her the time at the COSA
hearing.
I didn't get in, so I stood out and talked to Nikisha. And she is, you know, I get why she's doing this. She's not going to take nonsense from Jay anymore. And if she can help, she wants to.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing about this is just, you know, presumably how convincing Amy Berg and the HBO team are. I mean, Jen wasn't willing to talk to Serial. She's obviously featured prominently in this episode. Christina Vincent wanted to have her referred to as not her real name, Kathy. She's on camera here. So there's a lot of people, you know, Massey, people who didn't participate before who are now agreeing to go on camera and speak about this case.
So the benefit of the 3-year delay is they did get along on camera. They had time to work those angles for years. That definitely helped a lot.
Yeah, that is, well, props to her. Yeah, Sarah had about 10 months when she was working on Serial, so she didn't have much time. And it could be that, like, I mean, if Nikisha showed up for the COSA hearing, that means she's following the case. And it could be the others are following the case, too. And so maybe they're realizing things aren't exactly what they thought they were. Do we know if Jen and Jay are still connected? Do they still talk? Are they?
No, well, not to the extent that Jay talks to anyone, hardly at all.
So, I'm sorry, where did the episode end? Did it end with Nikisha?
It ends with Nikisha picking the phone, and she says, like, hello, hey.
Okay, yeah, so it ends with her calling Jay, and I think we're going to see a lot of that in episode 3, and I thought it was a real cliffhanger, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes of that conversation or any other conversations and what she can get Jay to talk about.
I will say this is definitely, like we said earlier, the catching up episode, the laying out the groundwork. And I thought they did an amazing job in the hour they had to, you know, select the highlights of the case, the parts of the story that mattered for the prosecution, and to explain it all. And they lay out exactly what Jen and Christy recall. And they today stand by their stories about what they remember. And they make it very clear in the documentary that their stories have not changed. That's what their memories are. And the question is, I guess now, look at the next couple episodes, is what those memories actually mean.
All right, thanks so much for tuning in this week, guys. Don't forget to check out this week's addendum as well. And last week's, if you didn't hear it, John Cryer's back with us for this season. And also this week, we're also going to be having another guest from the documentary. So definitely check it out so you don't miss that. And also, we want to let you guys know that we're very excited to be having a watch party for the final episode on Sunday, March 31st. That is the night that it will air. We're going to be at an auditorium at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. If you check out, we've both put the link on Twitter and on our Facebook page through Eventbrite. Get your tickets. About half the tickets are gone already. They are free. It is a totally free event. You can come. We're going to have a panel beforehand with me, Susan, Justin, and I think my brother, and I'm not sure who else, but and somebody to moderate it. We're going to speak for about an hour, take your questions, and we're all going to watch the final episode of the case against Adnan Syed together. So check it out and get your tickets now.